There you go. Okay. So, I'm going to talk tonight a bit about the shoulds and the foundation for Buddhist morality. We all carry around a set of shoulds in our heads. You know the shoulds. Mm-hmm. The shoulds are something like, I really don't want to go to work today. It's a really ugly day. But I'm not sick, so I should go to work. I should spend more time with my parents. I should do this, do that. We all carry around these shoulds, and they can seem very innocuous in terms of thinking goes. But actually, when you unpack shoulds, they actually, when they're added up, they give us peeks into the entire moral code or ethical code or the foundations for what kind of behaviors we believe are correct and incorrect. For example, this is just a simple statement, I don't want to go to work today, but I should because I'm not sick, but I'm tired and I don't feel like it. That statement, if you unpack it, holds a lot of views in it. For instance, it prioritizes physical sickness over being mentally tired. It's okay not to go to work when we're physically sick, but if we're stressed out or tired, that's not a good reason to not go to work. Stuff like that has a lot of interesting, what the Buddha called ditti, views packed inside of them. And ditti views, especially the harder we cling to them, can cause a great deal of suffering. We'll talk more about this. But when you look at the shoulds, especially from a therapeutic or psychological perspective, they often cause suffering, stress, dukkha, in four ways. The first is that very often our shoulds are unrealistic. For example, a whole generations of Americans had the idea, I should do better than my parents, which is going to create a lot of unrealistic expectations, especially when the economy is crashing and it becomes harder to find work. And of course, it's a very subjective idea anyway, what is doing better than one's parents. But just these shoulds that we carry around can often be, some kids carry around the idea, I should get an A on all my papers. Or I should do in the top 10% of my class. Or I should always have a job, or should do this, or whatever. Very often, not only does shoulds clash with external conditions, but the second problem is that a lot of the shoulds we carry around are incompatible with the other shoulds we carry around. I'll give you an example. There was a famous theoretician named Gregory Bateson, who in the 1960s wrote a book called Steps to an Ecology of Mind, where he demonstrated that a lot of the roots of mental illness and neurosis were in people carrying around incompatible beliefs in their heads. For an example, some of us believe on the one hand, I should be purposeful, happy, doing a lot of art. I should have a lot of friends. I should be developing a solid career. On the other hand, I should be entirely self-sufficient and never need to ask for help. Right now, those two shoulds, or sets of shoulds, sound very familiar. But when you really investigate them, they create enormous amounts of stress and suffering, because very, very few people innately know how to achieve happiness and goal-seeking careers and creative lives without asking for help. In fact, the Buddha, for example, taught that the foundations for the spiritual path and a path towards happiness is the willingness to surround ourselves with other wise people. If we surround ourselves with people who are creating stress or simply living lives of drama and needless suffering, it's very hard, for example, to cultivate peace, because all we're seeing is the ways to cultivate stress. Now, there are a lot of different objectives that people carry in life. The Buddha's objective is simply, how do we go about ending stress and creating lasting peace? And in fact, the Kama Sutta starts with all of the shoulds that the Buddha taught are only from that perspective. What should I do if I want to have lasting peace? There are, of course, lots of objectives that are different than that. When my grandparents came from Russia to the United States, they didn't really care very much about cultivating lasting peace. They wanted to get away from the Cossacks. They wanted to survive. They wanted to have make a life better for their children. So that was what their goals were, and that gives birth to a certain sense of shoulds that are completely different than the shoulds of somebody who wants to attain lasting inner peace. My grandparents worked, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, insane hours, so that they could put my mom through school, etc. So that, of course, not all objectives in life are the same. The Buddha's teachings are always in one stream, that stream of what can I do to create lasting peace. So when you hear a should in the Buddha's teachings, it's conditional upon that idea that he's talking about, this is what we do to achieve lasting peace and reduce stress in our lives. Of course, if your goal is, for example, to achieve lasting fame, if you want to be a famous rock star at all costs, if you want to be Donald Trump, God forbid, but it's an objective that a lot of people have, those goals will carry a whole different set of shoulds. So it's important to view the shoulds that come about in any state in terms of what the goals are. And again, these are the goals you're seeking are lasting peace and ending stress. And these are the shoulds that Buddha taught that come along with it. Now, a lot of times people's shoulds, the other two kinds of ways that our shoulds cause suffering, I should say, besides being unrealistic and incompatible, are we, A, don't reward ourselves enough for when we do live up to our shoulds, and four, we punish ourselves too harshly for when we don't meet our behavioral guidelines in our heads. In other words, if we do climb out of bed and go to work even though we're tired and exhausted, we don't generally note the effort that went into that. On the other hand, if we do decide to take a day off and we need some space, then we often feel guilty and beat up on ourselves. So in fact, the shoulds that we carry around are often driven by the stick instead of the carrot approach. You know what that means. Rather than rewarding ourselves, we beat up on ourselves. They're generally difficult shoulds to meet. Occasionally they're inhumane, and they're often incompatible with each other. And so often, these shoulds can actually lead to really horrible states in life. If you read the statements of white-collar criminals, my God, man, you had hundreds of thousands of dollars a year you were making, and still you stole from your company. What could possibly be the motive behind such behavior? And then the answer is, well, I felt my kids and myself should live in a certain standard of luxury that my job wasn't affording, so I cooked the books or whatever. And then when people do get to a place where they wind up in such a painful state they often turn to religions, for example, for a set of shoulds, because they realize that their shoulds are just driving them nuts. So they instead go to the shoulds of the Ten Commandments, or to the Islamic shoulds, or to the Torah, or whatever, because they are looking for a better set of guidelines to live by than all those shoulds that were placed on their head by their parents, by their own copying of people around, by their own sense of what's right, by prevalent views. I'm not going to talk about it extensively tonight, but the Buddha had a famous teaching to the Kalamas that completely threw away the normal way that we base our moral foundation and our way of discerning which actions are harmful and which actions are helpful or wholesome in the long term. But the Buddha was a man that avoided rigid moral absolutes, in the sense of, even though he very much had a clear idea of which types of actions would cause or were the likely cause of long-term suffering and stress for ourselves, and which actions probably would plant the seeds for long-term peace, he never believed that any one single action, or rarely believed, I should say, because there are a couple of exceptions, that any one action would always give birth to suffering. I'll give you the list of the ones you want to avoid, okay? You don't want to kill a Buddha. If you meet a Buddha, regardless of what our Zen friend says, if you meet a Buddha on the road, do not kill him. Because you are so fucked if you do. You really are. You don't kill a Buddha. You don't kill an arahant. That's, you know, basically somebody's achieved enlightenment. Normally, not always, but often on the renunciate path. You don't kill your parents. You don't kill people who've been benefactors. And you don't, this is the only one that doesn't involve killing, you don't cause a needless schism in a sangha, which means you don't go around criticizing other practitioners and trying to split up a group. You try to mend fences rather than split people apart. Those are the only actions that have definitive bad results that you're going to have a really difficult time, if not are impossible to undo. But the rest of them, and I'll give you some examples, of the precepts, refraining from killing, stealing, lying, causing harm through sex or intoxication, there are still many occasions where killers would be welcomed into the Buddha's Sangha and would be reformed. Angulimala, a man who killed 999 people and wore their bones as a necklace. That is a fucking badass. Is that not? I mean, that's not a guy you want to mess with. And apparently he was on his way to kill his mama, his old mom, which was that one action that he couldn't be, you know, he couldn't undo, and the Buddha stops him. And then he tries to kill the Buddha, but he can't catch up to the Buddha. The Buddha floats effortlessly in front of him. I love this. Eventually he sees that there's a truer way to happiness than killing to achieve his aims. And he puts down his sword and he picks up the robes of the renunciants. Now, for the rest of his life, when he would walk through town with his alms bowl, begging for food, the story goes that the villagers would throw stones at him. And he came to the Buddha, he had the nerve to complain. And the Buddha said, well, dude. The Buddha didn't say dude, but in this version he does. The Big Lebowski version says, dude, you have to expect that people are going to be slow to forgive you. You did, after all, kill nearly 1,000 people. There's another story of a soldier in the shorter discourses, Samyutta Nikata, where a soldier comes to the Buddha and says, you know, what's going to happen to me in the future if I continue to be a soldier all my life? And the Buddha says, well, if you really don't do anything else but be a soldier, the chances are very good that you're going to be reincarnated in your future life also, your future mental state. And really, when I say reincarnated, I just view like the future of your mind is going to be a really lousy one, because your entire experience is going to be made up of killing people and war shed and blood and all that. So you see, there's some, on the one hand, there's endless opportunities for undoing any act. We should never feel that any act, unless we kill a Buddha, right? You kill your, you know, your benefactors. Unless you've done something like that, there's no act from which you cannot recover spiritually from. On the other hand, when we do continually recommit unskillful acts, killing, stealing, lying, causing harm, there's five rules that make it even worse. If we do it repeatedly, if we put a lot of planning and effort into it, right? If you're like, really, I really want to fuck somebody over today, let me think a lot about how to do that. That's a lot worse than if accidentally, by carelessness, you simply say something that's a hurtful remark. So the more effort, planning, the more times you do something. And the key to all this, let me read you the others, because I took them down from the teachings. If you do it without remorse, if you do a bad action towards someone who is of great benefit to others, or towards someone who's been a benefactor who's done great things for you, if you do any of these things, you're likely to make the results worse. And I'm not talking, it's important to understand that Buddhism is not a theistic spiritual path, in the sense that the Buddha didn't say that the reason we're doing, we're avoiding causing harm is because there's a God who's going to judge us, and we're going to wind up, you know, it's like, you know, in the Christian belief, I gather that there's some God who's like Santa Claus. He's keeping track of all the things you've done, and there's a balance sheet, and apparently, but then they get complex too, because apparently if they confess, then they'll get everything forgiven or whatever. I've never gotten them, so don't ask me. My idea of how that works is very skewed. But the idea is that so long as that the actions that we take have long-term implications for our own minds. If we act out of greed, selfishness, delusion, if we are caught up in trying to achieve our happiness at the expense of others, the chances are the mind that we will be in the future will not be pleasant ones. That's what karma really is. It's a psychological insight. It's not a physical insight of physics. If you kick a dog, right? Most people think karma means that a dog sometime in the future will bite you. That's not karma. If you kick a dog, you're planting the seeds of causing harm, and the chances are great that in the future, or very likely that in the future, if you do that a lot, those seeds are going to result in a lot of stress and suffering. Basically, the minds that we live in are caused or created by the quality of our actions. It's a psychological insight, okay? So the reason why the Buddha is teaching this is so that we will get to live in the most peaceful minds possible, that we will reduce what he called kriya, mental agitation. The way we reduce mental agitation is by reducing the amount of harm that we cause. And also, we practice positive reflections. The Buddha taught about reflecting on the times that we're generous, reflecting on the times that we act from virtue. For example, if you wouldn't kill somebody for $5 million, you have something worth $5 million. You have virtue that nobody can take away from you, right? So reflecting on the times that we refrained from causing harm, when it would have been easy to lie but we didn't, when it would have been easy to avoid something that was difficult, but we didn't. Reflecting on these are very much a part of the path that the Buddha taught. So these are, in fact, part of the 10 essential recollections. So the Buddha didn't teach so much the stick only, as he also very much taught and more as a more of a working mechanism for our spiritual path, the idea of rewarding and reflecting on the times we live up to our goal that we're aiming for in our spiritual practice. Now, how do we develop, given that the Buddha said that we shouldn't, in the Kalama Sutta he talked about, we shouldn't take for granted the things that are passed on to us by common sense or by legend or by the stories or by even what our teachers tell us. The Buddha said the foundation and to the Kalamas is seeing for ourselves which actions are wholesome and which actions are unwholesome and taking the wholesome actions following the wholesome thoughts. So how do we do that? How do we figure out? There's two versions. Very simply, the first version is to his son Rahula, which is a very famous teaching. He basically told his 7-year-old son, before you do anything, ask yourself, does it seem like this action is going to cause harm to yourself or to another? If it seems like it's going to cause harm, refrain from it. If while you're doing it or after you're doing it, you see that you've caused stress or harm to yourself or to another being, then simply, A, don't beat up on yourself. There's no part in the teaching where the Buddha said, sit around, mope, feel bad, you know, think you're shit. That's not part of the Dhamma. In fact, what the teaching is to A, acknowledge that we've caused stress and suffering. B, find someone else who's on the same spiritual path or similar spiritual path. Acknowledge it and then set a goal to not do it again. The difference between, I think, the core difference in many ways between what the Buddha taught and what other spiritual paths teach is that the Buddha, of course, didn't posit the existence of a lasting identity or self that is unchanging. He looked at our actions in terms of the most important things we should watch rather than sit around telling stories about who am I really. So when you see an action that you've done that you don't like, you don't move on towards saying, oh, I lied today, that means I'm a liar. You don't turn it into an identity. You skip that step entirely. You don't turn it into a statement about who you are. If by accident you stole somebody's pen, right, you don't turn it into a thief, you don't tell that identity story. Instead, you simply see this action, I don't like the results. I don't want to do it again. I'm going to acknowledge that and move on. That's what he taught, right? So all that sitting around storytelling about what, you know, feeling bad about ourselves, beating up on ourselves, that's not the key. The key is to clearly see that our actions are causing peace or they're causing long-term stress and suffering. The key, though, is beyond that, is to not just see the short-term results of our actions, but the long-term. The difference between, the Buddha said, between a fool and a wise person is that the fool only sees the short-term. The wise person sees the long-term results. And that's the karma that's important. Sure, I guarantee you a crack pipe is always going to bring pleasure to you immediately. So if that's the way we're judging our actions, we should all be smoking crack right now. Because the short-term results are going to be very pleasant. Shooting up dope, avoiding difficult conversations, sitting around thinking endless stories about ourselves, worrying about what's going to happen to me in the future. All of these things bring about immediate sense of security or immediate sense of avoiding things we don't like. The key, though, is to see what do these behaviors do beyond the here and now. As the Buddha said when he was teaching his son, and he was teaching Yoniso Manasikara, right, appropriate attention, the key is to see the three results of our actions. What happens immediately, what happens later, i.e. later on in our life, and what happens really later on after we're dead. Now, most of you are not going to see what happens to you after you're dead, so I'm going to just suggest that rather than only seeing the short-term results of our actions, that we hang around and we don't offer so many different actions all the time, that we have a sense of mindfulness over what happens when I think this thought. Does my body get stressed out? Does my mind become claustrophobic? Do I generally do skillful actions when I think in this way? When I worry about what other people are thinking about me, for example, what happens as a result of this thought? What are other people thinking about me? Well, the results are A, in the short term, you think that you could possibly figure out what other people are thinking about you. But in the long term, you get really stressed out because there's no way you could possibly know. B, it really doesn't matter because their thoughts are changing all the fucking time. Three, you're not going to gain any wisdom from that thought. And you're going to sit around guessing at something that's totally unknowable. So it's going to create long-term stress and suffering. So you notice that, and eventually over time, you start thinking, well, wait a second. Do I really want to go here with my thinking? Maybe there's another thought that's less stressful. And this is, by the way, during meditation, a perfectly, perfectly appropriate thing to do. The Buddha often talked about, in meditation, observing our thoughts and seeing whether they create stress or whether they create peace. A good example of a thought that always creates peace, if you want to know, think thoughts of goodwill to yourself, to someone else. I guarantee you, you note that your body relaxes, the mind will feel more comfortable, you'll be less... That thought generally tends to not slam you all the time. On the other hand, the thought of what's going to happen to me in the future, that thought will follow you around like an unwelcome guest and really hammer you. So we view our thoughts in terms of not so much anything beyond whether they cause lasting peace for ourselves and for other people. Now, I'm not going to talk much beyond this. I'll just say that I'm going to be talking more about yoniso manasikara, which is, which is basically appropriate attention. And that's the more advanced way of developing a set of shoulds, which basically entails when we're about to do something or when we view our actions, ask ourselves, one, what am I getting from this? What is this action promising me? What is this? What are the rewards comprised of? What are the long-term and what are the short-term results? And what are my alternatives? When I talk about what the rewards are really comprised of, there's a famous example in the suttas of the Buddha before he left his dwelling to go after the contemplative life, when he was a very wealthy young man and he lived surrounded by beautiful dancing girls and musicians. And one night after he invited all the most beautiful women to come and hang out with him, they had all fallen asleep. And he woke up and he saw through the impermanence of their beauty and saw them as skeletons and corpses. Now you might say, oh my God, that's a bad trip. You shouldn't smoke that pot again. But really, what was going on was he was seeing through the idea that things are only their present condition. And he saw that the things that we generally attach to, they may look beautiful right now, but in the future, what will they look like? Or B, he also talked about if you really feel lust for someone that you shouldn't feel lust for. He talked about imagining what the different organs in their body would look like to see what they're really comprised of. Now, with people, that's a little bit more difficult, but sometimes when we're obsessed about things that we want to accumulate, if we ask ourselves, well, really, what is this thing that I'm so craving? This chair, this computer, it's generally a computer. I'm always craving an Apple computer. If I ask myself, what is this thing really? Well, it's just a bunch of little mechanical parts that project something on a screen. And I already have one of those. Why? It's always the max appearance, right? It's the sheen of the new one. But when we look beyond it, they're all the same. They do certain things a little faster, a little slower. But when we really investigate it, it's really nothing to get so bent out of shape about. So we'll talk more about that later. But again, the Buddhist charter of free inquiry is to really ourselves begin to investigate these shoulds that we're living under, that we've been tyrannizing ourselves. Is that a word, tyrannizing? No? No, okay. Jesus says it's not, so those words, those shoulds that we've been carrying around, beating ourselves up like clubs, asking and investigating them, really seeing if they do lead to long-term happiness and peace. Or are these shoulds things that are towards objectives that we're really not that important for us? Are we really prioritizing success over happiness? Are we prioritizing popularity over peace of mind? See really what those shoulds are, what they're doing to us, whether they're really compatible with each other. And when we do have a set of shoulds that are worthwhile, instead of beating up on ourselves when we fall short on them, reward ourselves when we live up to them, and when we fall short, simply notice and see the results and redouble our efforts. So I hope that was of some interest to you, and now's the time where you get to ask any question or share about anything that's going on. And I thank you for coming to Dharma Punks tonight.